Speaking of what we do, we tell our stories. And this final item for the day, except for the door prizes and the banquet, is telling our stories. It's a conversation about blindness, justice, and shattering misconceptions from the federal bench. I'm pretty excited about this. Two aspects of it. We've invited one of our own emerging leaders to guide this conversation that's going to happen here. This is our friend and colleague, blind lawyer Deepa Garaya, who's been known around this convention to guide this conversation. And the conversation is with a gentleman who we've long wanted to get at this convention, but in the past, he's had work to do, serving as a federal judge. Judge David Tatel did serve on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit from 1994 to 2023. And prior to that, he had an extensive career of doing civil rights work in private practice and in government. If you want to read extensively about his history, you should get his new book that's out. And I'm sure he will talk about that. Among his many positions, he was director of the Office of Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare during the Carter administration, and he was responsible, as we discussed yesterday, for helping to get the Section 504 regulations out under the Rehabilitation Act. We should say that in 1977, we did sue him in his capacity as director, and I'm told that he found it a little helpful, because our pressure, along with other people with disabilities, of course, we talked about that yesterday, helped to push the administration to know that it was important. And I think I'm confident you will find in this conversation, and if you read his book, that he is a true champion for civil rights. He's honest about his experience as someone that has come to understand his own blindness in a new way. And you'll get to know that he's multifaceted. Besides believing in the American justice system, he is dedicated to his family. By the way, he is here with his wife, Edie. They have four children and eight grandchildren. And so we're glad to have them here at this convention. Many other things you might learn about him. I appreciate that he's a baseball fan. So, with that in mind, I welcome Deepa to the stage, and we thought we'd give this introduction to Judge David Tatel.
Thank you, President Riccobono. Good afternoon, Federation family. I'm Deepa Garaya, and I'm here with Judge Tatel. Good afternoon, Judge Tatel. I wanted to start out by asking you about your book. I'm in the middle of reading your book. It's called Vision, and it's on Audible, and it's also on Amazon, and there is a QR code that gives 20% off to NFB members. So I highly recommend it. And Judge Tatel, I wanted to ask, starting out, is this your first NFB convention, by the way?
Yes.
Awesome.
And I'm very pleased. Edie and I are just totally delighted to be here. So
great to have you here. Well, with that, I just wanted to start out by asking you, you started to lose your sight as you became an adult, And in your book, you talk about how you're not known as the blind judge, but you regret not making that known. Can you talk about that inner struggle?
Wow, Deepa, you went right to the heart of the book awfully fast.
We only have 20 minutes.
I'm going to answer your question, Deepa, but first I want to thank President Riccobono for this wonderful opportunity to talk about my book. He already introduced my wife, Edie, but I want to introduce her again. Much of this book is about Edie and me together and our lives together. And I also want to introduce my guide dog, Vixen, who's right here next to me. So, as I said, Deepa went right to the heart of the book. I was diagnosed with RP when I was 15 years old in 1957. I had, like other people with RP, I had trouble seeing at night up until then, and no one knew what it was. This was a very long time ago. I was finally diagnosed at the National Institutes of Health, and I was 15 years old, and I tell the story in the book that I didn't want to talk about it. I look back on that. That was 60 years ago. I can almost look back at 15-year-old David Tatel as if he's, someone else. And I ask myself, why did he do what he did? Well, he was 15. He wanted to be like his friends. Kids want to be like their friends, right? And so I developed all kinds of techniques for covering up my growing visual disability, techniques that expanded as my sight declined more. When I went to college and law school. I was functioning as a sighted person, although my problems at night were growing. My peripheral vision was declining, and I was struggling to find other ways to deal with it without having to discuss it. Finally, when I was 35 and director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, the same job, by the way, that Kristen Clark had years later, I couldn't really function anymore sighted, and I learned to use Braille and started using readers. So that's the background. In 1994, when President Clinton nominated me to the D.C. Circuit, I was using a cane, but I was still, it wasn't much of a subject of conversation for me. And I wanted to be on the D.C. Circuit. It was the thrill of a life, but I wanted to be known as a judge who happened to be blind, not as a blind judge. And I would say that I've been on the court for 30 years until I retired. I've written over 700 opinions. And I like to think, I hope people think, that I succeeded in those years in proving that I was a judge who just happened to be blind. If I could say one more thing, Deepa, it's sort of, 'cause it brings me to the point I want to make, which is that people ask, well, why did you write this book? It's not a book I really wanted to write. I was convinced by people who I care about that my story could be inspirational, not just to blind people, but to sighted people who hire blind people. And I hope that the story the book tells, will demonstrate to the world, to both blind and, to be honest, mostly sighted people, that blind people can function at the very highest levels, and that the David Tatel who served on the D.C. Circuit for 30 years was a judge who just happened to be blind. So that's my story.
Thanks for that. Going along with that, you know, do you think your career would have been any different had you disclosed your blindness sooner? And, you know, have you experienced any discrimination in the workplace because of your blindness?
Sorry to laugh, but Deepa probably read this book more carefully than anybody so far. Deepa, I actually don't know the answer to that question. And I think I'd really be interested to know what people think who read the book. When I was struggling with increasing deterioration of my sight, it was a very different world than it is today. Not as different as it should be, but still very different from it is today. I worried, this was in the 1970s, a long time ago, when I was beginning to practice law, through law school and beginning to practice law. I worried that my employment opportunities would be limited if people knew I had a visual disability. It was that clear to me at that time. And I actually don't think, as I look back on the experience, that 30-year-old David Tatel was unjustified in thinking that. So Deepa, I don't know. I don't know. I do know this. I do know that as hard as I worked to downplay my growing and my declining vision, people who knew me and who worked with me, they knew. I mean, it was, as I wrote this book, I interviewed some old friends, quite a few of them, and asked them, you know, the old famous question, what did they know and when did they know it? And they were aware of my declining sight long before I was prepared to talk about it. So I guess the bottom line is I still don't know the answer to the question. I do know this. I talk in the book about how important role models were to me. Lawyers who were the kind of civil rights lawyer I wanted to be when I grew up. They were very important to me because they gave me, you know, a symbol of what I wanted, but they were also helpful in my career. What I did not have when I was 30 years old was any role models who were blind. None. There were no blind appeals court judges that I knew of. There were no partners in law firms who were blind that I knew of. So I didn't have that kind of role model. And one of the reasons I think why I wrote this book is that I hope that people who are the same stage of vision loss today that I was 50 years ago will see my story and my career as a role model for them.
Thanks for that. A lot of us do experience this inner struggle where, you know, we are trying to figure out how much to disclose our blindness and when and in the workplace or not in the workplace and, you know, especially those of us who have low vision or don't, you know, are not quite at that stage where we're ready to make our blindness visible. And so the book really highlights that struggle. And you know, I recommend people read that to understand that and know that you're not alone in your struggle. In the book, you also talk about, you know, being a parent of four children and how your children kind of took your blindness in stride and, you know, did stuff that you know, that came naturally to them, like describing things, going on hikes with you. I was wondering, like, if you could talk about your experiences as a blind parent and if you, you know, how that was, if you encountered any struggles with that.
So our children, by the time our first child, Rebecca, was 4 or 5 years old and, you know, aware of things around her. I, at that point, was I wasn't using a cane, but you know, I was learning to use recorded books, and I was beginning to function more visibly as someone with a visual disability. So I mention that only because all four of our children, their only experience was with a dad who had limited vision. And so we, at the beginning of this, we have four fabulous kids. They're all parents. One of them's even a grandparent now. They're four fabulous human beings, and they're great parents. And we asked them at the beginning of this process, we sent them a questionnaire that Edie and I wrote. I don't know, had a dozen questions on it. And they all responded with written memos, which are just total treasures to us. And we learned a lot from them. And I quote in the book in different places their observations about growing up with a blind dad. And there's lots of them throughout. I just mentioned two of them. One is I didn't know. She went out with some friends. Parents drove somewhere, and she came back. And she said she sold her siblings. I didn't know that. Dads drove. I didn't know that dads drove cars, because in our house, Edie drove the car. And then Emily, our youngest, tells a story that still moves both of us so much. She said one of her friends asked her, what's it like to have a blind dad? And she said, you know, it's just like having any other dad. He loves us just the same way any other dad does. She said, I felt loved, and it didn't make any difference to me. From my side of it, being a parent, I was more dependent on, well, two things I want to say. One is, at the same time they were, we were having children, and it was a time when parents read to their children. I was learning to use talking books at the Library of Congress, and I learned to listen to books with the children, and that was magic. All four of the children grew up reading bedtime stories with me with talking books. And, you know, they loved it, and I loved it. And I don't think I lost anything as a dad with limited sight because of those wonderful, wonderful books. And I did it with my grandchildren, too. It's gone one after the other. And then the other thing I'll say is that, you know, I was more dependent on my children than sighted dads are, both for just moving around. Our children, it was natural in our family for the children to take an arm when I needed it, and I never even had to ask. And by the way, that's gone on to the next generation. Even the littlest grandchildren still do that in the Tatel family. And the book is full of stories about that. Probably the most dramatic example of a dad depending on his children is my years of skiing in Colorado with the BOLD program. And probably a lot of you know about BOLD in Colorado. But at the end, in the last 4 or 5 years of skiing, two of my children became my guides. Ski guides. And talk about a dramatic example of parents relying on their children. Me skiing down the Big Burn, led by my teenage daughter and son, was about as dramatic an example as you can find of anything. So, yeah.
Awesome. I'm learning how to ski myself. So,
okay. we'll talk about that afterwards.
I want to get to an important question before we run out of time, a big one. What problems do you see stemming from the Chevron decision that came out a few days ago from the Supreme Court for disability rights, and how can the blindness movement come together to combat these problems?
Do we need to say what Chevron is for a minute, do you think?
Yeah, why don't you talk about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, okay. Or do you want to do it?
No, you go ahead.
Okay. DPS has asked a really, really important question for our country as a whole, but also for the disability community. Chevron is the doctrine. Chevron is named for Supreme Court opinion. It's not a gas station. It's a major Supreme Court opinion, Chevron versus the Natural Resources Defense Council from, I think, sometime in the 1980s. A unanimous decision of the Supreme Court, which said that when a court like mine reviews a regulation issued by an agency, let's just make this very specific to the issue that everyone here is concerned about. Let's take, for example, the regulations issued by federal agencies under Section 504 and the ADA. All right? I mean, those are the regulations we all care about in this room. So what Chevron says is that when the agency issues those regulations or when it announces interpretations of them, that the courts, and they're challenged in court, which of course they always are, right? The court has to ask two questions. The first question is, does the statute, that is 504, the ADA, or whatever the statute is, does the statute clearly make the regulation invalid? In other words, has the agency exceeded its authority under the statute? And if so, the court has no choice but to vacate it. But those are very rare cases. The second part of Chevron is, if the statute's not clear, if it's ambiguous because it uses general language, then the courts have to defer to the agency's reasonable interpretation of the statute. Okay? So let's take, for example, the disability laws, right? They're very general statutes. They speak in very general terms. Thou shalt not discriminate on the basis of a disability. That's what it says, right? And the agencies, HEW in my case, or EEOC, or the Justice Department, interpret that general language by issuing specific regulations saying exactly what that means in practice. You know, what exactly do schools and universities have to do to accommodate blind students? What do they have to do in terms of Braille? What do they have to do in terms of readers? What exactly is their obligation? They flesh out the statutory language. And when those get challenged in court, since obviously statutory language that says you can't discriminate based on disability doesn't clearly prohibit the agency from saying, you know, schools have to provide readers for the blind. The question is that a reasonable interpretation of the statute? And one of the reasons why I think the agencies that enforce these laws have been so successful, not as successful as they should be yet, but still successful, is because the courts have deferred to the agencies under those. That's what's happened for the past 40 years. These agencies, these regulations that flesh out the general language of the disability laws have survived legal challenge because the courts have deferred to them. The Supreme Court last week overruled Chevron. That's no longer the law. And so now the question will be, judges like myself who have these cases will have nothing to go on but the general language of the statute. We'll have the agency's interpretation, but we'll have no obligation to, quote, defer to it. We can read it as we would a brief, but it has no binding effect on us. My worry now is that there will be a huge amount of litigation in the next few years challenging agency regulations, not just in the disability field, but throughout. And the courts will strike down lots of these because the language is so general. The courts will say, I'm talking about the conservative courts, their view will be that unless Congress specifically authorizes something, that the agencies can't do it. And this is very dangerous right now because it's bad enough without Chevron, but our federal courts are becoming increasingly hostile to federal agencies and the regulations they issue. And I think it's going to be a huge battle for advocates, for civil rights advocates, whether it's under, you know, Title VI or the disability laws, to defend the progress that's been made with all of these regulations. I think this is a serious turning point. It's going to be a major challenge for the lawyers working in the disability community to defend what's been accomplished and to keep agencies aggressively enforcing the disability laws in the future. It's a serious problem.
Do you have any ideas on what we can do as an organized blind movement or other disability groups on, you know, combating these?
These cases are going to require, this isn't the first time in my career that we face a challenge from hostile courts. Mm-hmm. We faced it before. This is actually the worst, I think. Wow. It's going to require superb lawyering. I'm looking at this from the point of view of the lawyer. There's so many other things that groups like NFB and others can do in terms of organizing and bringing attention to the problem and raising money. But the fact is the battle is going to be fought out in the courts, and it's going to require superb lawyering. So the simple answer is, Deepa, people should go to law school. People should learn to litigate.
More lawyers, yep.
And, you know, NFB and the other groups should develop the toughest, most aggressive legal groups you can, because they're going to be badly needed.
There we go.
I'll say one more thing. Can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
There's one more thing I'll add here. This may sound naive, but, you know, our government has three branches of government, not just one. It's not just the courts. There's Congress and the president. And although it seems like an uphill battle, both of those agencies, both of those branches can be a check on the courts. And so one thing we should be focusing on Congress. We should be getting Congress to write legislation that's specific enough to support what the agency's doing. So it's very clear that when the agencies issue strong disability regulations, it's supported by the law.
Okay.
Same thing when it comes to presidential elections. You should be voting for presidents who understand that what their obligations are to faithfully enforce the law. And then there's the entire 50-state government system and state and local governments, which aren't affected by these regressive Supreme Court cases. A huge amount could be done at the state and local level in terms of not just... Right, yeah. So that takes organizing state by state. It takes raising money. It takes electing good members of state legislatures. It takes supporting the legislative activities of those bodies. It takes working with governor's offices, mayor's offices, city council. Huge amount can be done to protect civil rights at the state and local level in this country.
More advocates, legal and otherwise.
That's right. That's right.
I don't know how much time we have left, Professor Gabono, but I just had a couple more questions.
Sure.
No time left. but we do need, there's many questions we could ask, so I hope this won't be the last opportunity. But I do think, Judge Tatel, we should ask you to give a minute or a minute and a half to what role the National Federation of the Blind has played in your success, because I know you've had many intersections with the Federation over the years, and particularly one service, but there might be others. So.
Well, I think the point you made right at the beginning. So when I became OCR director, it was the beginning of the Carter administration, which, if you remember your history, followed the Nixon-Ford administration. And the Nixon-Ford administration had done everything it could to close down the civil rights programs and had done nothing to they even refused to issue the Section 504 regulations. And the civil rights groups, including the National Federation of the Blind, sued HEW and OCR. So when I became the director, I became the defendant in the lawsuit brought by the NFB to force HEW and OCR to issue the regulations and enforce the law. And the reason why that's so important is that it's a great example of how advocates on the outside can work with advocates on the inside to do things that neither of them can do alone. I could not have gotten the 504 regulations issued or the policy interpretations we issued under them. I couldn't have got that done without the pressure of NFB and the other civil rights groups. Because when I'd make the case within the Carter administration for issuing these regulations, and I get pushback, my answer would say, well, you can push back all you want, but there's a federal judge supervising what we're doing, and he's going to rule against us if we don't issue these regulations. So it was a great example of, as I said, of how powerful advocacy groups like NFB can shape how government agencies work, particularly if your allies take jobs in the administration. It's a great combination. So,
well, thank you for being an ally, Judge Tatel. We do need to say, though, that you're one of the most avid users of NFB Newsline. I know that that's a daily tool that you have used, and it's talked about in the book. And Judge Tatel, probably many questions we'd love to ask. We're pleased that you and Edie will be with us at the banquet tonight. But I want to point out an important moment here, speaking of Newsline. In his book, Judge Tatel recognizes a number of people. One of them is one of our staff who works on NFB Newsline. This will be his final convention as a staff member, as he's retiring later this week. So we should give a round of applause to Bob Watson. So Judge Tatel, there's many other topics it would be great to talk with you about. Oh, yeah, we're gonna give you the last word, okay? We will give you the last word. Let me say one more thing, which is before you leave the stage, I just want to say, you know, the National Federation of the Blind has taken on many things, and you talk about some of those intersections in your book. One of the things that we did, you discuss in your book, accessible currency, and we undertook in 2009, a little bit before that, to get the first ever U.S. coin to have real readable Braille on it, the Louis Braille Bicentennial Silver Dollar. So before you leave the stage, we are going to give you a Louis Braille Bicentennial Silver Dollar. You get the last words, Judge Tatel.
Okay, well, in addition to thanking you once more, Mark, for this wonderful opportunity, I want to say, and Edie will vouch for this, I probably spend 3 hours a day, 7 days a week with Newsline. From the very beginning, and I don't know how many times over the past many years I have sent emails to Bob Watson and Scott White. For all I know, all of those emails to Bob may be one of the reasons he's retiring, just to get away from them. But Newsline is the best example I can think of just a phenomenal program that allows blind people to function totally independently. I love it.
Thank you so much. All. Yeah, thank you for being here. I encourage you to read the book, and we look forward to having you at the banquet, and we look forward to the continued relationship to get your wisdom as we do our advocacy with the courts and as we get out to vote to make sure that we're represented in all the halls of power.